Hi, I'm John London. Welcome back to Thinking It Through, a twice monthly podcast where I try to explore the personal connections that people make with their history and their personal geography while they reflect on who they are and who they hope to become. In the initial four episodes, I spoke with a number of people who live on the Big Island of Hawaii. Well, today's episode is the culmination of that group of interviews, and I speak with a local woman, Ms. Laomi Bergnut. Laomi is the mother of two adult daughters, has a 40-year marriage with a now-retired astronomer, Lars Bergnut. Laomi's life has been one of cultural and family respect, some wanderlust, and plenty of Hawaiian pride. She's a remarkably diverse native Hawaiian. Her bloodlines include many cultures, including Hawaiian, Portuguese, Japanese, Spanish, and Korean. Learning lahala weaving from her mother and the love and respect for the land and ocean from her Japanese father, Laomi's talents and sensitivities go well beyond just a professional resume. She agreed to speak with me for about an hour or so at her home near Hilo, and this is our conversation in her backyard on a rainy weekday in 2018. Well, Laomi, thanks a lot for talking with me today. It's raining, and I think we can hear that on the recording today. Laomi, why don't you tell me a little bit about who you are, why you live in Hawaii, all those things, just as a little introduction for the audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up as Laomi Leiko Sugihara, and I actually grew up on this island in the Waikea area, and my dad was a commercial fisherman. And he's Japanese, and he's second generation. Mm-hmm. And then my mother is Korean and Hawaiian, and she was pretty basically a homemaker and a master lahala weaver.
Yes.
And she was known for weaving hats.
Yes.
I have five sisters, and I'm the middle child. And between my older sister and my younger sister, there's 19 years.
Yes.
Apart from it. And I guess we've lived on Oahu. My husband is from Sweden, and I have two children, two daughters,
mm-hmm.
Who are in their 30s. My mm-hmm. older daughter, Miley, lives in Fort Collins, Colorado. And my daughter, Malia, lives here, and she's a veterinarian. We came back to Hilo in 1986 and lived with my family, and then we bought this home.
Right.
And I've been living here, but quite a long time we lived on Oahu. Yeah, my husband was going to college then and finishing up his master's degree in chemistry.
Right.
He had an opportunity to work up on Mauna Kea
mm-hmm.
As a telescope operator. And so we talked about it, and then we decided to move back because of all the hustle and bustle on Oahu.
Right.
And we also knew that we could never own a home there.
Right.
In the 80s already, we were paying rent for a three-bedroom house, which was really cheap at that time. We were already paying $1,200 a month. And we just didn't see that happening. And then majority of my family was here also.
Your sisters?
Yeah, my sisters and my aunts and my uncles and my cousins.
How far are we in miles from where you grew up?
We are probably about 10 miles from where I grew up.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
In the old Waikea area near the community college in the civic. That area has changed quite a great deal.
Right.
Because now it's part industrial. The family home is still there. My sister is living there. She took care of my mom and my dad before they passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But I never thought that we would actually move back to Hilo.
Uh-huh.
Because, number one, I never really liked the rain. Because
it's
of my,
right now.
I know, because of my allergies.
Right.
And I have really bad asthma.
Right.
And the volcano started, the VOG started when my younger daughter was born in 82.
Right, this VOG affected.
Yeah, and it hasn't stopped.
For some of the listeners, tell me a little bit about Vog. I mean, we could.
So the Vog is actually volcanic haze, and right. it's kind of like smog.
Right.
Except it has the sulfur and the elements from the volcano that comes out from the crater.
And I know just in traveling too, it's pretty serious.
Yeah.
Somebody recently
just passed away. Yeah.
Yeah. Some yeah.
Tour guide. Yeah, right. They have something that's called laze. And what happens is when the fog is very thick and if it rains, it creates this sulfuric acid that is actually toxic and poisonous if you inhale it. So that's one of the reasons why I didn't think that I would ever come back to Hilo. Although my husband, even though he had a very difficult time with my family, because he's Haole, although my mother would always say he's European.
You wrote that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was her justification.
Uh-huh.
And later on, he became like my father's favorite son-in-law because he was very handy in fixing up things around
right.
the house
right.
and, you know, with the cars. And he also liked to go fishing.
Right.
And he was the only son-in-law allowed to go on my father's boat.
Because he knew what he was doing?
Yeah, and my father wasn't afraid of, you know, if something happened, of losing him.
Right, right.
My younger daughter, on the other hand, was forbidden to go on the boat. Because when she was 3, she was on my dad's boat, and she just jumped right in the river.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
stuff. And after that, right. he said...
Did he have to go in after her?
Yeah.
yeah.
She knew how to tread water already.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, no more kids.
Yeah, that's enough with the children until they learn how to swim or get a little older or something like that. You know, let's see if we can focus in on just a few things. Again, in thinking it through, what your perspective on this is different than the other interviews I've done, in that you are definitely Hawaiian, have an understanding of the language and the culture, and not so much as a transplant, which is legitimate too. I mean, people can have an impression. You don't have to be born here. But maybe we can go back to your life and growing up as a child. Is there anything about Hawaii or being Hawaiian or being multi-ethnic as a child that kind of stands out, or things that you realize that your family was doing that appeared maybe some people weren't doing, or some cultural differences as a child?
I think one of the things that many of us in my generation, my age, I'm 62, is that growing up during the 60s, in 1960 when we became a state, I was only 5, it wasn't really popular to be Hawaiian. So many of us who were part Hawaiian, a lot of our friends didn't know that we were Hawaiian and things. And that language wasn't also spoken. We were forced to speak. All of us were forced to speak standard English.
There's no Hawaiian in the schools at that point.
No, because I didn't realize this until I got older, that it was actually forbidden. And there was actually a law stating that Hawaiian could not be spoken.
I believe that goes back almost... back to when it became a territory.
Yeah,
right?
and that law was not removed until the late 70s.
Right.
And
right.
things. So a lot of people didn't even know we were Hawaiian until my older sister got accepted into Kamehameha schools. And we lived in a Japanese, pretty predominant Japanese neighborhood. And it was also close to Wailoa River, where his boat was. So it was a convenient location that they grew up in. And he was actually one of the few fishermen that actually owned a home at that time.
Is that because the economies of fishing
were
really tough?
Yeah, it was really tough. And so a lot of people didn't even know that we were Japanese. I mean, that we were Hawaiian.
Right.
And because I do not look Hawaiian, even till this day, some people will question sometimes.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know, are you really part Hawaiian or not?
But the language is spoken in your house as you were a child. What did you hear?
Language was spoken in our house. We had Hawaiian was spoken once in a while. Mm-hmm. My father, because he was an aku fisherman, a tuna mm-hmm. fisherman, mm-hmm. he was basically gone 5 days a week.
Okay.
So during that time, we actually grew up with some Japanese and some Hawaiian
okay.
in the house.
Okay.
But as far as speaking it in the house, we weren't allowed to.
Okay.
Yeah, and okay. we weren't allowed to speak it in school. In fact, Pidgin English was also forbidden.
Right.
And we have stories among my friends and I where we would actually get paddled.
Is that right?
Yeah, in class.
For language.
For language.
Wow.
But if anything, among many of us, a lot of the culture came out in the food that we ate and the food that we shared.
Right. So it was almost like it's not language kind of, oh, let's hide
right.
the Hawaiian as much as possible, but let's embrace some of the
yeah,
traditions.
Yeah, so some of the traditions. So definitely right. like baby luau's were a really big thing.
What is a baby luau? What is,
so when your child turns 1 year old,
all right.
they have a really big party and it's called mm-hmm. a luau. And they'll have traditional pig. Mm-hmm. The pig is slaughtered a certain way. Mm-hmm. And it's cooked in the imu, the underground oven.
Uh-huh. Are there things that are said or are there religious things that are said? Or
it just depends. It just depends on your family.
Yeah.
Like how far you want to go mm-hmm. in it. But you also have to realize that a lot of Hawaiians were Catholics and mm-hmm. Mormons.
Right.
So that's the other thing, too. But that was something that was pretty traditional for a lot of families.
Okay.
Was that. And also, too, even like simple things, like when you go to someone's house
right.
or you visit someone, you always take something with you to
right.
share.
Right.
We always had really big potlucks together.
Right.
At school, even though we had school lunch,
right.
a lot of times kids would bring snacks and we would share it among ourselves
right.
and trade food and
right.
stuff like that.
Right.
So, yeah.
This kind of repressed Hawaiian culture piece, when language was allowed in schools in the 1970s, by then you were well out of school.
Mm-hmm. And it was still very slow.
But it was slow, yeah. Tell me
in
a little
coming
bit about
back.
How it might have evolved. Yeah, I don't.
A lot of it evolved, I think, with the Hawaiian Renaissance was actually, I believe, I'm not really sure, but I think mm-hmm. a lot of it evolved because of tourism.
Okay.
And a lot of it came out of Hawaiian music.
Okay.
And hula.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how it became involved. And some families already were practicing. You know, I kept the tradition of language
mm-hmm.
at home, but they wanted to see their grandchildren
mm-hmm.
speaking fluently. And
mm-hmm.
so Punana Leo,
mm-hmm.
which started, I believe, on our island, was one of the first schools that started with young children.
Was it an immersion program?
Yeah, it was an immersion program. And that's when I believe the charter schools were first discussed.
Okay.
The other thing is that the University Hawaiian Language Program decided that we needed to standardize Hawaiian language.
Right.
And there's some controversy over that also. It's
Charge
like
it
what
or?
Words you would be using,
right.
how
Which
it
generation?
Would be written.
Mm.
And how new words would be formed.
And you were telling me yesterday that this whole written aspect of the Hawaiian language is almost contrary to the oral tradition. Of it, right?
So now some of us are having discussions about what is more important,
right.
the oral or the written.
Right.
So you will see some Hawaiian literature or even advertising done, and they'll have a little blurb there. That they do not use like the kahakos and the okinas, the glottal stops
okay.
and the diphthongs in their writing.
Okay.
Because they believe that if you're able to read and speak Hawaiian, then you should be able to interpret what the language is saying.
From context to, yeah.
Yeah, from the context.
Yeah, interesting.
So I think that's the other thing too. And language, I think Hawaiian language is also very related to our environment. also in the way the words were formed in the old days.
Explain that a little bit.
Computers, when we grew up, we called them Lolowila. So Lolo means crazy, like crazy wires. It's really big because, you know, all the wires in the computer.
Right, absolutely.
So that's what our elders, like Kupuna, called it. And so for many years, even like for the laptop, I would call it Lolowila until one of my students, a Hawaiian language student, we've been having discussions. So Lapeka is really great.
Uh-huh.
And she's actually from Molokai, from a very well-known Hawaiian family.
Uh-huh.
And we'll have this discussion, and she'll say, Auntie, why do you call the laptop Lolowila? And I said, well, what else would you call it? Because we never had laptops.
Right.
So whatever we called the desktop computer, we'd go over to whatever was new. And she said, no, we don't call it that. We call
it's got a different name.
Yeah, it's got a different name. And they don't even call the computer Lolowila anymore. They call it Kapukala.
Okay.
So what they've done is they've anglicized the Hawaiian, the English words into Hawaiian. Which I don't know is really a good thing, because to me it seems like it's an easy way out instead of using a higher form of thinking.
Okay.
And developing new words.
Yeah,
the other one was sodas. Because for us, we just, when we grew up, you know, sodas, we didn't have all this Mountain Dew and all these different types of sodas.
Coca-Cola.
Yeah. Right? And we just called them soda.
Yeah.
And whatever you got, you drank.
Right.
And so they used to call it Momona Vai. So Momona means to be fat.
Okay.
And Vai is water. So it was fat water because it was sugary. And if they knew that if you drank a lot of it, that
and
you
didn't
would
move much,
that you would gain weight from it. And now they have different names for all the sodas.
In Hawaiian.
Yeah, in Hawaiian.
Oh, that's funny.
So that's the other thing.
So it does evolve into more complicated
Yeah, it has. And the other thing, too, is that I think what's really great is that you can go anywhere now and hear Hawaiian.
Right.
Where in the old days, it was just a few people that spoke Hawaiian.
Right. You mentioned the Renaissance, and again, I'm naive here, and when was that?
That would, the Renaissance, I think, was in the 70s.
In the 70s
and
well.
80s, yeah.
Okay. The language was brought back into the public schools. And
And it was
embracing it.
And it was even really, I mean, it's still a struggle, I think, to this day, because we still have a lot of Hawaiians. Our Hawaiian children who do not speak Hawaiian.
Right.
And one of my things is that just because you don't speak Hawaiian doesn't mean that you're lesser than other Hawaiians.
Right.
Because you still have the knowledge and the culture and the baseline, the foundation there.
Right.
It's just that you're speaking it in a different language and not in the native language.
Well, it's a fantastic place in that that I don't think there's any populated area more remote than Hawaii in terms of population. You know, it's thousands of miles from California or
Asia.
Because
we're an island state,
So remote, and without perpetuating or embracing an invitation to the language for locals. It will disappear.
And what's interesting, too, is that a lot of us who don't speak Hawaiian, especially those in my age, we understand the Hawaiian. So sometimes I will have some of my students speaking Hawaiian, and then later on I'll answer them in English, and then they kind of like...
Oh, you heard that?
We have to be careful with our conversations here.
Exactly.
And then the other thing, too, that I've been teaching them, too, is that please do not go around correcting people how they speak Hawaiian, because there are many different dialects. And yes, they're learning what we call standard university Hawaiian.
Right.
But if you go into communities, Mm-hmm. You're going to find all different types of nuances.
And dialects. And things. Right.
With the Hawaiian. Right.
I would imagine that in Pahala, where we live, it's different.
Oh, yeah.
Because I would hear it a lot, but I never understood it. But, just getting back to your childhood, all things childhoodish, when you think of this island and think of what it has to offer in terms of climate and weather and so on, any connections to the land that you still hold strongly today because of your experience as a child?
Oh, yeah. I think for us, well, for me, it's really being connected to the ocean.
Okay.
We spent a lot of summers, I remember, camping for weeks at Spencer Beach Park on the other side of the island.
Sure.
And my dad would also take us to Mahukona, because Mahukona actually is a navigational site.
Where is that?
It's near Hawaii.
Okay.
On the way by Kaihai. Sure. And there's actually a navigational point there in which, if you're in the right position, you can see all the islands. Unfortunately, because of the fog right now, it's very difficult to see that. There was a time last year when the wind had shifted, and a lot of us that were going over the Saddle Road was able to see, I think, all the way to Oahu because the wind had shifted and cleared up.
Awesome.
That was a really rare sight. I have some photos of it that later on I'm going to reproduce. But definitely the ocean. We were always at the beach.
Right.
If it was a... this is ironic. So, you know, Hilo rains a lot, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So in school, on a sunny day, it was not unusual for parents when we were little to come and take children out from school to go to the beach.
To celebrate the day.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
If you did that today, they would look at you strange.
Right, right.
But that was something that was done in those days when we were little.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
You also wrote a little bit about, and some things that I looked at, about the tsunami and its impact. Tell that story a little bit.
Oh, well, my dad, because he was a commercial fisherman, always got the tsunami warnings ahead of time.
Yes.
Because they had to take their boats out into the ocean.
Right.
And at least 4 miles out. So in the 64th tsunami, he got the alert early, and my mom doesn't drive, so my aunt would always come and pick us up and take us over to their house near Keau. And
were you in danger possibly, or she just
because we are definitely in the tsunami area.
Right.
We have stories about like Granny Smith, our neighbor, like during the 1960 tsunami, that she was hanging on to the coconut tree.
Oh my gosh.
But I actually went back to bed.
You were like 8 or 9 years old.
I was like 8.
Yeah. Eight,
and then my sister awakened me up and said, "Oh, we gotta go and whatnot." And then I just never got out of bed and just went back. And then when they went to my aunt's house, my mother was counting who was there, and she goes, "We're missing."
Oh no!
So then they had to come back and come and get me, and then So when the missile alert thing went off a couple weeks ago, my sister called from Waimea, and she asked, and she said, "What were you doing when the missile alert went off?" And I said, "I was sleeping," and she just laughed.
Yeah, it's your go-to.
Yeah, and she said, "Typical."
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just fall asleep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But our area where we grew up from the 1964 tsunami changed a lot.
Uh-huh.
Because Waikiki High School, where I went, is now where the Naniloa Golf Course is. So we changed schools and went to Kapi'olani Elementary School. The area where the Civic is across from there, and where Waikia Village is, used to have there used to be like a Kanek mill, there used to be a lumber mill, and some other areas there. All of that was destroyed, and some of the family areas in there also. Where they play soccer, there was an area there called Shimachi, and there was another camp a Chinese camp and a Portuguese camp. Part of the Portuguese camp is still there. It's by 7-Eleven behind by St. Joseph's School. Mm-hmm. And that was called Villa Franco. Mm-hmm. And but all of that area got wiped out, including the there was a theater called Cow's Palace in the main parking lot in Bayfront, and that was also wiped out
too. Right, so entertainment sites.
Yeah,
well, I get a sense people who haven't been to Hilo probably aren't aware of this, but definitely there's still tsunami sensitivities, just with development as well, you know, sometimes.
Oh yeah, so we thought it was strange when they built the county and the state building and even the new federal building where it is, because those are tsunami zones.
Yes, yes.
And people who lived there actually were relocated to this area.
Oh, okay.
So that was the other thing too that happened. Yeah.
Was that after the seawall, and they thought maybe they had some safety?
Yeah,
in the
and then they had to build the bridge to Coconut Island. One of my girlfriends, Lilinoil Young, she works for Commitment Schools. Her family used to live on Coconut Island, and that whole area was totally destroyed.
And it gets flooded to this day. It's been
flooded
within the last few months. It was flooded.
But it never used to be like that before. And so when you talk about global warming, we're seeing it.
You're feeling it. With the coconut. Yeah, because I recall, what was it, like 3 months, a couple months ago, it was
with flooded. The high seas. Yeah, and then also to Bayfront, the Black Sand Beach area.
Sure.
That beach used to be, I think, twice as big before and stuff.
And these, what are these waves? Those king waves or something? Are they more prevalent now, or is that just
It's something new now because of the global warming.
Okay.
And with the way the wind and the tides have shifted. Also, I was in Waikiki when they had the first bout last summer, and it was amazing.
Let's get back to your childhood just for a bit, because I want to touch upon some people that had a big impact on you, maybe in your love of reading or education, because that's where you've spent a lot of your professional life.
Yeah, so my grandmother, my Japanese grandmother, her nickname was, at home we called her Baba-san, but out in the open we had to call her Oba-chan, which is a more formal grandmother name. They were Shintoists, and so they practiced Zazen meditation. And because I used to be sick a lot with my allergies and asthma, she took me under her wing and taught me meditation from when I was 4 years old.
That's incredible.
And stuff, and so we would have to sit and meditate every day, as much as I hated getting up in the morning. And stuff, and she would try to, you know, do those type of things. And she also taught what people know as Reiki. And also they used to do this thing called, which is kind of funny because my acupuncturist actually does it also, where they actually burn certain points on your body with this, like a ginger thing. I think now they call it moxa.
Okay.
It's made out of ginger, but the Japanese call it yaito. She used to do that also to kind of help with my breathing and to open up more of my passageways and things. And because I stayed home a lot too, my older sister, Sharon, who lives in Waimea, she used to read a lot to me. And so she actually taught me how to read.
Right.
And so I was reading already fluently by the time I was three.
And
it wasn't Dick and Jane books. It was like real hardcore books, like Homer. And
I need to comment. I need to comment just briefly. I'm at Lay's home, and there are books everywhere. So this is a family that reads.
They were really a big influence on me, I think. And then the other thing, too, was that after the tsunami, my mother put me in Girl Scouts. And so my Girl Scout leader that I had for the longest time was Barbara Allen, and she just passed away last year. And she really believed in us. It was really interesting. She was from North Carolina. Her, they had moved here, and you know, they wanted a different type of life. And mm-hmm. they lived in Kyokaha. I don't know if you know where.
No, I don't.
It's Kyokaha is the largest base of Hawaiians on this island. And they moved there with a little red-headed.
Is it down in the ocean?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
And Susie
know where that is, yeah.
is totally pale white and red-headed.
Not very Hawaiian.
Yeah, and she grew up down there, and they loved it. She really taught us a lot about trying to believe in ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the one thing she really wanted us to do was to travel. So she took us to some of the other Girl Scout camps on the other islands. But the other thing that happened was an opportunity called Wider Ops. And she had seven of us apply for it. And I got selected to go to New York when I was a junior in high school. It was going into senior year. And that was my first trip to the mainland.
And that's quite a trip. I mean, that's as far as you go on the
mainland.
Yeah,
and I still remember my dad was really nervous, and my mother was like crying at the airport and stuff and whatnot. But there were actually five of us that left Hilo at the same time, but we all went to different places. One of my girlfriends actually went to Ghana.
Wow.
And so all of us like to travel, and we try and get together every so often. Mm-hmm. But she really believed that just because we lived in Hawaii, we didn't have the other opportunities that were on the mainland, didn't mean that we were any less of ourselves.
Have you carried that into your own family with your girls and encouraged them to?
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is that with a lot of Asian families and Hawaiian families, education is really important. Mm-hmm. And that was her big thing also, was that she wanted to make sure that we would either go to community college or we would go to the university and be happy in whatever we wanted to do.
Let's move from your childhood into now, obviously. There's a large, dramatically important part of your life, which is with your children and family and living and doing a lot of different things within the community. Did you find yourself to be somewhat restless? Because I noticed that you started going to school in the 90s, right? You started taking some courses and so on.
I actually went to college and then dropped out because my husband and I moved to Oahu, and then we wanted him to get his degree settled, although he already had two degrees from Lewin University.
He loves school.
We started our family, because he and I are 8 years apart. And so we started our family, and then when we moved back to Hilo, when we were in Oahu, we were in a co-op, a daycare co-op. And so I got interested in teaching. We moved back here and got into the education system here also. And did that. One of my best friends, who was also the head teacher that I worked under, because I was actually trained to be a reading specialist.
Okay.
She said, "Why don't you go back to school already and think about getting a degree?" She said, "It might not be a teaching degree, but it would get your foot in the door to see what you wanted, and also, as opportunities arise, then you can go into those positions."
Sure.
And just to backtrack a little bit,
sure.
While we were on Oahu, I actually got certified to be a hairdresser, to be a cosmetologist.
Oh, all right. Okay.
So that was my background there. Yeah. And I also did some office work at First Hawaiian Bank. And she said, my girlfriend Jane, and she said, "The nice thing about you is that you're open to a lot of things. You're very observant about things. And so you're quick to catch on to certain types of things also."
Yeah, so you're doing a lot of things.
Yeah, so
already.
I went back to college and I got my early childhood degree, which two of my other girlfriends also had. And I worked with Head Start with them, and also at the Children's Center, the preschool at the community college. And then I went into DOE and was at Waikea Elementary, and found out I didn't want to be at DOE because I could rarely get my foot and a coli in the door at 8 o'clock.
Right.
And luckily I was with a teen teacher.
Okay.
So she came in early, and then, you know, I would kind of like slip in the door. And then I did that for a couple years.
Right.
And then I said, I don't think I can continue this anymore. Went back and got my English degree.
Right.
One of my great mentors actually is Diane Ferreira, who's in our yoga class.
Ah.
And she was one of my first English teachers and started me on writing, because I had already been doing journal writing.
Mm-hmm.
And she had entered my poetry in a competition that placed. And she said, you should go into English because you can write. And no one should tell you that you cannot write,
mm-hmm.
because you're from Hawaii.
Mm.
What's ironic is that later on I went through the Bread Loaf program with Middlebury College.
Right, right.
And the first session I took was in Alaska, and one of my mentors there, Courtney Kasdan, bless her soul, she just passed away recently.
Hmm.
It was so funny because they assumed that I was going to be a white person because of my last name, Bergnut.
Sure. Yeah,
So when they came to the airport to pick me up, mm-hmm. there was this car going round and round. And then finally I asked the guy parked, and I asked him, I said, are you looking for someone from Hawaii? And he goes and he says, yeah, I'm supposed to pick this woman by the name of Laomi Bergnut. And I looked at him and I said, that's me. And he looked at me with his eyes really wide and said, oh, okay.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
Her comment was the same thing, which was really interesting, was that we don't get many writers from Hawaii.
Mm.
And you guys can write.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And stuff. And so she wanted to know, why is it that there aren't more writers coming
mm-hmm.
out from Hawaii?
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, I said, you know, it's what you guys are writing is a different style of writing. It's more like classical, what we would consider standard English.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't fit in with our environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So native writers aren't going to be coming out.
And it was funny because she laughed and she said, you know, when we got your poems, we were going to tell you needed to go back to school.
Mm. Mm.
Because when I write poetry, a lot of times I don't use capitals and stuff. And she said that she came to realize after reading that there was a reason for that and stuff. And I said, yeah, it's because it's not part of our,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not part of our culture here.
Right, right, right.
It's not the capital with the I's, it's always about the we's.
Right, and so you were making a point within
the
poems, and they thought you were just maybe grammatically
incorrect.
Naive or incorrect or something.
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting.
Kind of, yeah, that's really interesting.
And luckily my husband was, my girlfriends always say, oh, you're so lucky to be married to Lars, because I know that if I had probably married a local boy, I would never have had those opportunities. Because I have girlfriends who aren't even allowed to drive to Kona.
Is it part of the culture?
Yeah.
It's a
patriarchal culture, and it's very old school.
Mm, mm.
And mind you, what's really funny is that our cultures here are actually matriarchal.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But we let the men think they're running the business.
I think I know that culture. With that one experience, that Middlebury experience, did you find that turned out to be really pretty inspirational for you? I mean, pretty much self-affirming? Or
It was a really great experience.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, it was an eye-opener for me, because out of 150 students, there were only 8 of us that were minorities.
Hmm. Wow.
And we kind of hung out each other with, you know, it was kind of interesting with some of the older students, because I was already in my, late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
It also showed me how patriarchal, it's still there.
Mm.
Because we had students that were very, I mean, Middlebury College and the Bread Loaf program, I loved it. But they're also very steeped in old history.
In tradition.
Yeah, in tradition. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, those like Yale and Harvard and all those.
Right.
And so we actually had some students there, very young students that I met that were very, they'd really not been exposed to other types of cultures or even other modes of thinking because they come from families that are already very wealthy, very well set.
Somewhat insulated. Right?
Yeah, insulated like one of the girls in my group that I still keep in contact with, she's actually related to the Kennedys. She went home every weekend.
Oh my gosh.
To Massachusetts.
From Alaska?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
To Boston.
Oh my gosh.
They flew her in and out in a Learjet.
She got a nap. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
She didn't know how to wash her clothes.
Oh, yeah.
I had to teach her how to wash her clothes because I found her throwing away her clothes.
Sure.
And buying new clothes.
It's dirty. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Oh my gosh.
And stuff like that.
Yeah,
and
crazy.
Then a lot of them had never even cooked a dish before. There was a little kitchen in the dorm that we were in, the housing unit we were in. And on Saturdays, some of the older students and I would go out and go fish for salmon.
She had never done that.
And we would come back and we would cook and, you know, and we kind of would make it like a potluck. And some of the younger students would come. And it really was kind of an eye-opener that the things that we assume is common sense or part of life is not part of their lives.
Now, have your daughters, in talking with your daughters who have been on the main, at Colorado State, you know, did they ever talk a little bit about that? Now, you told me yesterday that they're not going to be seen as Hawaiian, right? They don't appear to be Hawaiian physically, so maybe they don't bump into that. But
they were part of the Hawaiian, but they said that a lot of times people would mistaken them for being Chicanos.
Yeah.
For being Spanish, because, you know, they're kind of...
Dark hair.
They're dark haired, but they're still kind of mixed-like, and they're still kind of fair.
Sure.
So I think that's the other thing. And I think for them, Colorado State was really a good place to be because it's such a diverse... You know, they have come across that where people forget that, you know, they are part of Hawaiian and that they do speak Hawaiian.
Yeah. They must,
They and they've been dancing hula since they were three.
That's interesting. Yeah, you know? No, they've had, I'm sure they have an interior life that's pretty interesting. Coming from a multi-ethnic family and from this island.
Yeah.
And like you said, one is here, right? The veterinarian. And working with nature and animals and so on. You know, at this point, you recently retired, and retired from what position?
I did the Kalamaku Student Leadership Program at University of Hawaii Hilo.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that.
I was in that position from 2009, and it was developed by a group of students, faculty, and staff because we felt that there was leadership was lacking. With a lot of students, and also we wanted to incorporate Native Hawaiian values because we have a lot of transient students that come to Hawaii because they look at us like a resort college.
Right.
We wanted them to also be aware of the cultural values here and also be more fully aware of the surroundings, the environment, the places they go to. Like I do a walking meditation at night at Hale Mama.
Okay.
And one of the things we've taught the students is that from the time we leave Hilo to the time we go up Volcano, we're not allowed to talk until we come back and debrief. And it's very frustrating for them.
Do you collect their devices?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We've had to collect their phones.
Yeah. It's usually, well, it takes, if the weather's good, it's like half an hour to drive there. The walk that we do is about 20 minutes and stuff. So we do take about a good 2.5-3 hours.
Sure.
And, you know, teaching them that you have to respect that area of the national park.
Right.
And the other thing, too, is really being mindful of their language. even on campus, because we are a state institution, we do have visitors that come in. It's not okay to be swearing left and right or being disrespectful about something.
Right, right. In that leadership position, with the sprinkling of the Hawaiian, is that like a primary strain in that leadership group, Hawaiian culture?
Yeah, it is based on our five cultural values that the group selected, and one of them is being an alakai, which means being a leader, and how to be mindful. Another value was laulima, how do we work together? And kuleana, also how do you take responsibility? We also had malama, and we used the three values in malama. So malama aina, taking care of the land. Malama ohana, how do you take care of your family? Mm-hmm. And malama akua, which is how do you take care of spirituality with your relationship to God and the environment. Mm-hmm. And then we also had another value, which has to do with how can you, it's kind of hard to explain, but it has to do with the visions that you may have for the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great little segue in terms of your own life at this point. What is your vision for the future for Laomi? How are things going to unfold?
My vision right now is I need to go back and take care of my health, number one, because the last 2 years have been very strenuous.
Okay.
And I am diabetic.
Okay.
My allergies got really bad again with the asthma, also because the weather is changing.
Yeah.
The other thing that I want to do also is to work with some organizations in town, whether it's with grant writing or with being on their board.
Because you have experience in those too. We didn't get into all of your resume, but I know you have experience in
that. Yeah, with the grant writing.
Right.
And making sure also too that our Native Hawaiian students have opportunities for them, whether it's going to be cultural practice, and education.
Right.
And so I also work closely with the Maku'u Farmers Association. And some of those students that are actually working there were actually part of my master's program.
What are they doing within the farming? Are they in the business end?
Either within the business end of running the farmer's market and trying to develop their cultural center there.
Okay.
And also making sure that the students who want to continue their college education or want to go off island have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
One of my goals with the Native Hawaiian students also is that there shouldn't be a differentiation between how Native you are.
Right.
On whether you speak the language and know the culture or not.
Right.
Because if your heritage and your bloodline is being part Hawaiian, then you are Hawaiian.
You're in.
Yeah. It's up to those students to decide how they're going to use them.
Right.
What I've seen, which I tend to sometimes provide conflict or some ways of thinking differently at the university. We're not only providing for students in Hawaiian studies and Hawaiian language. We have to provide for our Native Hawaiian students who are also in marine science, astronomy, teaching, ag, whatever.
So you can embrace several things.
Right.
You don't need to shut the door on anyone.
Right. The door should always be open to them.
Right.
Because the thing is that no matter what, they will always come back eventually into the cultural practice so that Hawaiian language and Hawaiian culture will thrive eventually.
Right. Right.
In a backwards kind of way.
I really enjoy for me, the isolation of Hawaii and of the culture of which you speak is really fascinating And it would seem to me the mainland could use a heavy dose of all the time.
And it's one, also, it's also too, if I can interject, it's also too how some of us look at what is, what are we as an aloha state, and how do we use the term aloha when we're with other people. So for some of us, I take more the viewpoint my mother had, which is that aloha means to live life intelligently. Forget about the thing about, you know, A is for this and L is for this and that whole thing.
The t-shirt thing.
I mean, it's still an important part of it, but it's like isolated and taking all those things into making it a cultural component. Where in reality, it really means how do we thrive and how do we live intelligently. You know, so I think that's the other thing.
My last question. All right, let's take money off the board. Let's take let's take security off the board. Even I don't want to divorce you from your husband or family, but if you could do, if somebody could come with a wand and just say, you've got a wish, too, what would you like to do with your life?
I don't know. That's a really difficult one. I mean, first of all, I would love to be debt-free. I think that's the, that's one really big thing, because I think so many Hawaiians have become homeless because of the debt.
Right.
And because they didn't know what taxes were in the old days.
Right. Right.
And stuff. But as for me, I think I would just love to, I wish I had a private jet and could just travel wherever I want. And I've had some offers from some, like a former student of mine is from Burma.
Okay.
And she actually has a nonprofit, and I've been wanting to go with them, but she's been kind of hesitant to take me because of my health problems.
Okay.
And I think the other place that I would really love to explore more is, I think, part of like Bali and Cambodia. That part.
Yeah.
And maybe even India too. One of my students actually, his family is, he's actually from, I think, from Nebraska or somewhere like that. But but they're Hare Krishnas.
Okay.
And his grandparents are missionaries in South India.
Right.
Yeah, and so he said that, you know, anytime you want to come, you can come with us. And I told him this. It was interesting because I told him, you know, I've always been afraid to go because everybody I know gets sick. He says, Auntie, if you want to go, you just have to go.
Have to do it.
You can't worry about getting sick.
Well, this wish would bring you healthy.
That was kind of interesting having that conversation with him. And I said, you know, John, you're so smart for being only 21.
Well, Naomi, thanks so much for speaking with me today, and look forward to hearing you on the podcast, Thinking It Through. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, you're welcome.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Well, I want to thank Naomi for the great conversation. There's so much to being on the island of Hawaii, and I think she covered so many of the bases, be it her childhood, living with a Japanese father and a Hawaiian mother, living by the ocean, having mentors telling her that she could become anything that she wanted to become, and taking those lessons to heart. This wraps up the Hawaiian interviews, and I want to thank all the people of Hawaii for their generosity with their time and their ideas. Thanks again for listening to Thinking It Through. My name is John Lund. Have a good day.